So my plan today is to give a cursory sense of the project and then to dive into this section, which concerns how and why protection space has become a euphemism for rightless relief. Just to give you a sense of what's ahead in terms of your experience here, I want to share with you a memory that's kind of important. The single most important academic paper of, not important, the one that's had the longest impact on me was given by someone whose name I don't remember at all when I was affiliated with the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. That's where I first met Romola. This person was a quantitative social scientist who had engaged in a very, very deep study of the optimal length for lectures, such as the one that I'm supposed to be giving right now. And this person came to the conclusion that after many surveys, that the optimal length for an academic lecture is 37 minutes. The reason being that after 37 minutes, the majority of your audience is actively engaged in sexual fantasy. My talk is 42 minutes, so that at least there'll be 5 minutes of fun, okay? It won't be entirely a waste of your time. Let me get started. Many scholars in the present have begun to write quite brilliant works and about suspicions that Andrew and I also share, to the effect that the present humanitarian order is, in reality, a kind of repressive politics, specifically a kind of way of managing the world's undesirables and maintaining them as undesirables, in the sense that Michel Agier, Fitzgerald, Didier Fassin, and many other scholars have suggested. This project, Global Shelter Imaginary, is less concerned with restating those conclusions than with analyzing a unique aspect, a unique feature of their rationalization. The Global Shelter Imaginary concerns, the broader project concerns the legitimation horizons of the contemporary humanitarian order. By reviewing the public career of a partnership between IKEA and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to sponsor a universally replicable camp dwelling that they call the Better Shelter, this work, the one we're trying to finish, examines how the same order has come to rely on architecture, or sometimes just the image of architecture, as the plenipotentiary for the same protections that it's rapidly abandoning. More specifically, the work situates the successful public rationalization of the same better shelter within a broader failure of humanitarian reason, as it is increasingly subordinate, as it increasingly subordinates the political condition of rightless relief to the technocratic image of relief. Completing a general shift from what Romola and her co-authors have described as the protection of refugee rights to the protection of refugee bodies, the condition described here as a global shelter imaginary demands critical analysis because in commonplace talk about architecture and broadly about technocratic solutions to humanitarian crises, what one actually encounters is a decisive shift in the history of biopolitics. That is, in the forms of government concerned with the regulation of biological life. And the reason is this, because here and now, by the time we get to a global shelter imaginary, the same bare life that political philosophers have observed with horror, precisely because it reveals how the rightless are suspended in a biopolitical state of exception, now presents itself to view as the moral end of the humanitarian order itself. The fruition of cosmopolitan right. No more lesser of two evils arguments when it comes to humanitarian action. The refugee, design, technocracy is seen as a desirable end in itself. just before I continue, what you're seeing in the background are the actual better shelters about which we're writing, the so-called better shelters. What you're seeing in the foreground is what happens with their packing boxes. They become better shelters. And to some degree, this slide is an allegory of everything we're trying to present in the book. So just to give you a little bit of background, more background about the book and how it's structured, and then jump directly into the protection space part, which is, I guess, why some of you are here. Everyone in this room probably knows that the UNHCR estimates that around 1 out of every 112 people on the planet is now displaced by war or persecution, with the factors generating this catastrophe showing virtually no sign of abating. As part of its response to the largest dislocation of humans since World War II, UNHCR now partners with its largest private sector donor, IKEA, in promoting the work of a Swedish social enterprise called Better Shelter. Building upon IKEA's success with flat pack design, packaging, and logistics, the Better Shelter's mandate is to transform the landscape of camp humanitarianism by producing a universal and replicable post-emergency dwelling. Purposely designed to have a maximum lifespan of 3 years, the Better Shelter is marketed as a pragmatic compromise between temporary emergency shelters, that's just a fancy word for tents and tarps, and the kind of permanent habitation presupposed by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees mandate to provide durable solutions to forced migration. For this reason, the Better Shelter is often presented as an example of the way that smart humanitarianism, this is another euphemism for market-driven paradigms of aid, outflanks the bureaucratic conservatism of intergovernmental bureaucracies by responding to facts on the ground with nimble design thinking. The observation that inaugurates our study is simple, even if its consequences are actually deeply complex. Arguments for the Better Shelter confuse the causes of a political reality with its resulting artifacts and posture the imputed causes of a present crisis so that they retroactively conform with given solutions. The UNHCR is, on the main, tasked with two big mandates. It has two jobs to do. The first is protection, and for the undergraduates here, protection here basically refers to rights, not to, you know, it refers to rights in the sense that it is to serve as a surrogate for the state, as a guarantor of lost political rights, and assistance, which refers to the provision of durable solutions, humanitarian relief under conditions of emergency. In the context of international politics attending these mandates, tents and permanent dwellings, though, are not reducible to architecture. They are instead indices of a very real juridical political incongruity between the two mandates of protection and assistance. In protracted displacement crises, the UNHCR has repeatedly been forced to abrogate the protection mandate, the provision of rights, or their insistence on the provision of rights, in order to secure states' consent to the provision of assistance. More than this, as administrators of misery, the UNHCR and other intergovernmental bodies have regularly been forced to rationalize indefinite internment under provisional conditions. Human bodies, as Romola has told us, are protected at the expense of human rights in a context where permanent residence under emergency conditions constitutes the de facto durable solution to protracted displacement crises to begin with. I mean, the statistics are staggering. Only 4% of the displaced are ever able to return to their homes, as those who seek asylum are in turn forced to submit to internment strategies that deny fair adjudication of their asylum claims as well. The most astonishing documentation of this has come out in a recent book by Fitzgerald called Refuge Beyond Reach, which speaks about the precise strategies that Western democracies rely on to make sure that no one can actually claim asylum to begin with. He refers to this as strategies of remote control. So treating the perceived irreconcilability between the prerogatives of sovereigns and the demands of human rights as if they were simply a matter of splitting the difference between the lifespans of tents on one side and houses on the other, the better shelter effectively normalizes into oblivion the fact that humanitarian government actually organizes itself around the management of limbo. And yet, here I am wasting years on this, the better shelter matters. Not because it actually inaugurates a significant advance in humanitarian government, but because it is credited with doing so. This is what urgently demands analysis, in our view, the subordination of the dispossessed to a particular iconography of predicament that implicates architecture, or at least its image, in the amelioration of forced migration, and in the process, valorizes a condition of rightless relief. The term global shelter imaginary, which we introduce here, consequently describes the hypostasis, which just means the precipitation, of forced migration into the same political and moral slot assigned to homelessness in domestic politics, so that the subordination of protection, the subordination of rights to that of housing, the realm of assistance, appears as a moral triumph in its own right. Stated most directly, what we mean by a global shelter imaginary is the subordination of the refugee to the given notions of refuge, to such an extent that the refugee is then redefined, requalified as that person who fits within the given notion of refuge. Those who are not are no longer considered refugees at all. So the work broadly progresses from an introduction to the global shelter imaginary through the various and interesting forms of social capital that is exchanged between the UNHCR and IKEA. Like, just think about it. Every time I say UNHCR and IKEA, you probably should want to laugh, right? What are these people doing with one another? As well as the concatenation of social capital that is exchanged in valorizing the better shelter as a triumph and an improvement in humanitarian the humanitarian order. For example, this hut ends up taking pride of place in a Museum of Modern Art exhibition and is then credited throughout the web and professional literature as the next advancement in humanitarianism. And these transformations in social capital, these exchanges, to our mind, are important because they introduce doxa. They introduce the uncontested terms of contestation on the basis of which something like a better shelter succeeds in replacing the displaced with their own concept. The second section reviews how the GSI, the Global Shelter Imaginary, reinforces a politics of apoliticism, in the words of Pierre Bourdieu. This is, in essence, the next step in what Jung once called an anti-politics machine in connection with the field of development. So that what we're interested in is how claims for the better shelter's technocratic function actually erase any conversation about the politics that are advanced that are advanced in making that argument. We essentially suggest that the better shelter creates a better refugee in the minds of those who promote it, someone whose needs are defined in such a way as to be answered by amenities rather than by rights. These are then universalized as, in fact, the universal attributes of well-being, which now begins to tell you why it is that Swedish design professionals are so interested in this topic. Lastly, having successfully kind of worked through the reified rights into the universal shelter paradigms, the global shelter imaginary that we are trying to expose, in a sense, is capable of extending its so-called logic beyond the sphere of camp humanitarianism and the emergency dwelling. The majority of the world's refugees, as most of you probably know, and the displaced live under conditions of pirate urbanism and beyond the administrative and more probably the ethical political umbrella under which the current humanitarian order could understand itself as a moral stakeholder. And that's where the story of protection space comes in. So let me get started with the part that will be easier to understand. As we've reached a moment in human history when a strategic partnership in impression management between the UNHCR and IKEA has successfully subordinated the brute fact of mass dispossession to the architectural image of its alleviation, it would seem that a global shelter imaginary does now hold sway. The given solution, a flat-packed dwelling, now defines the problem of forced migration so completely and effectively that the majority of the world's displaced are now, in effect, disappeared in the representation of their plight. Within the given logic of this global shelter imaginary, the dispossessed are either disqualified by the provision of humanitarian relief from consideration as humanitarian subjects worthy of political rights, or worse, they're recruited into a new, specifically urban paradigm of protection that is actually indistinct from abandonment. This global shelter imaginary, we argue, takes two principal forms. In the first instance, it presents itself to view in the idealization of camp humanitarianism itself, the idea that we need to make refugee camps better. As, in a sense, the better shelter introduces itself as a kind of improvement that facilitates the perpetuation of the so-called camp bias at exactly the moment in history when the majority of refugees, many of whom were born and matured in camps, have actually decided to abandon lives under a permanent state of exception in order to take their chances in environments where the UN offers no prospect of appeal or protection. In the second instance, the global shelter imaginary introduces itself to view in the way that the UN has subsequently euphemized the same lack of protection as if it were the opposite, as if it were the inverse. A fictive protection space that extends humanitarian governance into what my friend and colleague Mike Davis has termed a planet of slums. That is, a condition of pirate urbanism under which the majority of the world's urban population now lives. Am I on the right slide? Yes. The relationship between the better shelter of a declining but normative camp humanitarianism and the protection space that's nominally extended to a growing urban refugee population is not merely paradigmatic, it's historical. These two notions of contemporary humanitarian doxa, the better shelter and protection space, began to complement one another and in the process to complete a global shelter imaginary in the context of a crisis of classification that took place in 2005. Then, a group of Sudanese migrants who had been denied refugee status by the UNHCR in Cairo decided to build their own refugee camp directly in front of the agency's office to protect their relegation to what is referred to as closed file limbo, a lack of recognition by the UNHCR as subjects worthy of political protection. They built their own refugee camp and parked it directly in front of the offices of the UNHCR. It took an act of self-internment for them to be noticed in an urban setting. For over 3 months, approximately 2,000 people self-interned in their own refugee camp in a place called Mustafa Mahmoud Park and organized their lives through committees tasked with maintaining the community. This so that they might better appeal and protest the manner in which their asylum claims had been adjudicated by the United Nations. The Sudanese migrants' claims against the UNHCR may well have been motivated by self-interest, but they also expose the workings of a geopolitics of abandonment contrary to the agency's mandate. In the course of its effort to assist populations trapped between sovereigns, as Emma Haddam put it, that is, between the will of states that generate or receive the dispossessed, the UNHCR has been repeatedly forced to erode the first of its mandated functions, international protection of rights, and to compromise on the second, which requires it to offer assistance leading to durable solutions. Unable to challenge state parties to meet their own obligations pertaining to the legal protection of refugees or asylum claims, the agency has sought to fill the gap and over time found itself the world's chief administrator of misery. It is a government of limbo for those who cannot resolve their asylum status, but who can also not move on. Where the search of durable solutions once referred to the repatriation, integration, or resettlement of the dispossessed, it is now a term of art and nothing more that refers to humanitarian governance over those for whom the right to protection or the right to asylum is increasingly a fiction, even for the United Nations. The Sudanese asylum seekers' key demand was that the UNHCR resume the practice of conducting individual refugee status determination interviews. These are called RSDs. And in June 2004, the UNHCR had suspended such interviews and automatically provided all applicants with the yellow asylum seeker cards, which offer temporary protection against refoulement, against being sent back to the state that's endangered you. The agency seemingly took this step in response to an announced ceasefire between the government of Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Army, the SPLA. But in doing so, the UNHCR in Cairo weakened core protections of the 1951 Refugee Convention, which calls for the adjudication of asylum claims on an individual basis. This statute, in a really fascinating aspect of this legal history, was actually demanded by Western powers at the time that the Refugee Convention was signed, because the U.S. in particular feared that otherwise asylum could be granted en masse to huge hordes of aliens. But conversely, that demand, that aspect of the mandate, also protects asylum seekers from exclusion as members of a mass. So the Sudanese were essentially making a perfectly legitimate argument on the basis of the convention itself. The Sudanese protesters correctly understood that the agency's action both as a weakening of the protection mandate and as a prelude to what they themselves termed, and this is as Orwellian gets, compulsory voluntary repatriation. This is what they were feared they would be subjected to compulsory voluntary repatriation, forced to decide to leave themselves so that no one could say that they had been victims of refoulement, which is exactly what the United Nations Refugee Convention is supposed to protect you from. So the fear was the pressuring of yellow or red card holders who had already been denied asylum to return to the Sudan on the grounds that the conditions that were or would have been the basis for their asylum claims no longer obtained, and that for this very reason, their status no longer required a review. Their fears, the Sudanese migrants' fears, were not in the least bit unfounded. In the decade following the fall of the Soviet Union, the UN effectively relaxed the standards of protection for repatriating populations and developed terminology and concepts such as safe return, which stipulated that conditions in the home country did not have to improve substantially, but only appreciably, in order for the UN and not the dispossessed to determine what might reasonably qualify as voluntary repatriation. As Gil Lesher, one of the principal historians of the UNHCR, has explained, in the course of this so-called decade of repatriation, the distinction between voluntary repatriation and refoulement was blurred. And the UNHCR even participated in acts of forced migration. The UN would eventually facilitate the repatriation of over 300,000 refugees to South Sudan, despite continuing insecurity and conflict there. The key point here that I'm making is not that these actions resulted in mass suffering, though they did, or that the UN eroded the voluntary character of repatriation under rewordings like safe return, though they did, but that in the course of doing so, the UNHCR established a really important precedent for euphemizing abandonment as protection that would prove relevant to the emergence of a global shelter imaginary. For its part, the UNHCR's Cairo office repeatedly disqualified the protesters standing as persons of concern to the UNHCR, even as the spectacle of a self-built refugee camp in front of their Cairo offices may have forced the agency to enter into negotiations with them. In a press release issued on 30 October, the UNHCR sought to invalidate the protesters' requests, which again foregrounded concerns about refoulement by other names, and for that reason petitioned the resumption of the RSD process. The UNHCR advanced two arguments. The first was that the protesters were for the most part not refugees at all, but economic migrants from southern Sudan who fell outside the agency's mandate and so had been accorded closed file status. The second was that the signing of the peace agreement in South Sudan increased nexus requirements for status recognition and created new opportunities for protection back in their home country, so that from the perspective of the UN, their responsibility to refugees from that area had suddenly changed. None of this was actually true. As the FMRS report on the protests makes clear, first of all, the demonstrators were from all parts of Sudan, and a survey of the park population undertaken in December showed that 43% had yellow asylum seeker cards, and 24% even had blue recognized refugee status cards that gave them the right to be where they were. The majority of these souls were or should have been persons of concern to the UNHCR, while the remainder may have been victims of various forms of category fetishism. Negotiations continued, and following the intervention of a delegation from the UNHCR's headquarters in Geneva, a tentative agreement was reached on 17 December 2005. The UN would reopen the RSD determination process, including the closed files, but citing security concerns, it stipulated that individual protesters could not return to the park after their cases had been reviewed. In a challenge to the remarkable and sustained display of solidarity practiced by the Sudanese protesters, the UNHCR effectively presented them with a variation on the prisoner's dilemma, in which collective action and self-interest were presented as contrary impulses, as contrary alternatives, and irreconcilable ones. The astonishing thing is that none of the protesters defected. None of them opted to have their RSD re-adjudicated at the expense of leaving their comrades behind. No one defected. The protesters accepted the agreement but refused to abandon the park until all cases had been reviewed. On the 22nd of December, the UNHCR communicated with the Egyptian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and indicated that it would do no more, thereby paving the way for the forced removal of the protesters. It later denied that it had done that. On the evening of 29 December, approximately 4,000 riot police surrounded the park, attacked the population, and killed at least 28 protesters. Approximately half of the dead were children, most of whom were trampled to death. The survivors were sent to Egyptian detention centers. Many of them were essentially harassed out of Egypt. The only reason I ever learned about this case to begin with was because a number of these souls made their way by foot to Tel Aviv, where I first heard of the case, as Tel Aviv is where I was doing research at the time. How does this connect with protection space? Anybody know this guy? You know him? Yeah. Do you think that's a fair characterization? Do you think he's like the Rowan Atkinson of Egypt?
Yeah.
Okay. I would have said Woody Allen, but that's so not politically correct now that I couldn't think of a better analogy. In both its attitude towards the Sudanese asylum seekers and its strategy towards their 3 months of protest, the UNHCR Cairo office had either adopted or coincidentally reproduced the commonplace attitudes of the UNHCR's institutional culture that had been laid out in a controversial 1997 policy document concerning urban refugees, largely identifying urban refugees with irregular movers who leave a country of first asylum for the purpose of assistance shopping in another. The 1997 UNHCR Comprehensive Policy on Urban Refugees sought to disaggregate opportunistic migrants from the ranks of those who might be legitimate persons of interest to the agency, and then to disincentivize the behavior of what it considered to be, what it called, rather, professional refugees seeking further assistance in place of resettlement, in place or resettlement in third countries. In their eyes, you couldn't possibly be an authentic refugee if you were not in a camp. The events in Cairo in 2005 would be credited in part with triggering a comprehensive reconsideration of the UNHCR's restrictive urban refugee policy, and with the subsequent release of a new policy document in 2009. Reviewing the negative generalizations of the 1997 policy paper as artifacts of an institutionalized bias that favored unjustly the individual treatment of urban cases compared to those in rural settlements and camps, the new document suggests that the former policy's concern with assistance mining actually coincided with the agency's lack of concern with its own obligations under the protection mandate. To rectify this, the 2009 document used the notion of protection space for the first time as its organizing principle, and it states it quite clearly. The author notes, when refugees take up residence in an urban area, whether or not this is approved by the authorities, UNHCR's primary object will be to preserve and expand the amount of protection space available to them. Let me tell you that something is desperately wrong here. And it bears some elaboration if one wants to understand the proper relation between the concept of protection space and the extension of the global shelter imaginary. Jeff Crisp, the author of the 2009 policy revision concerning urban refugees, was correct to foreground the institutionalized bias and bigotry, in fact, evident in the earlier policy document. The earlier policy document made all sorts of assumptions about the fact that Sudanese could never actually be authentic refugees because they were nomadic in character to begin with. There was an entire classification of humans on the basis of their origin as authentic and inauthentic refugees. It was really a troubling piece of work. So it's impossible to overlook the fact that the UNHCR Comprehensive Policy on Urban Refugees, as I said, suggested that some national groups were, by virtue of their nomadic traditions or their histories of economically driven migration, more prone to engage in forms of irregular movement and bad behavior. But in point of fact, one of the principal concerns of that repudiated 1997 urban refugee policy document was the erosion of the protection mandate posed by what they called an assistance paradox, a game of chicken into which the UNHCR had been forced by host states in their dealings with urban refugees. Both the 1997 document and a prior 1995 document that informed it are in part responses to a condition in which some states had shifted eligibility determination onto the UNHCR, letting the UNHCR determine who gets to be a refugee, and Egypt was one of these, and then ceded responsibility for assistance to those people in the same process. The result, they argued, was that the agency sometimes falls into a trap of providing assistance year after year in order to buy and retain asylum. The flawed and biased reports of the 1990s were clearly misguided in thinking that the UNHCR should begin to deny assistance to urban refugees under some circumstances. They were quite concerned that this would lead to dependency syndrome among the refugees. But it's also clear that their authors feared the creation of a condition in which assistance would eventually become a substitute for protection, exactly the condition that we're arguing has taken place. On the face of it, the term protection space would merely seem to refer to the location where the United Nations protection mandate and the host state's protections obligations and responsibilities overlap and are in force, either by mutual consent or tacit agreement. There, asylum seekers and refugees exist in a legal zone free from the persecution and from which, free from persecution and from which they will not be returned to a territory where life or freedom could be threatened. In context, protection space also implies an extension of the zone of places, of that zone to places beyond camps, which are historically the normal abodes of protection itself, in order to address the perceived protection gap among the dispossessed who are in other locations. Nothing could be further from the truth, however, as Goodwin Gill, Fortin, Stevens, and Ramcharan all have shown. There are originary differences in the definition of the term protection as it appears in the governing treaty documents, and these have generated vigorous debates concerning its meanings and its import. Is protection to be understood in terms of surrogacy, that is, as an extension of responsibilities abrogated by the state that expels you? Or does it demand prima facie a broader conception of the term that extends beyond the fulfillment of a legal and political obligation to ensure the rights of the dispossessed? On one hand, the UNHCR has answered the question in the affirmative. On the other hand, the perceived need to expand the given definition of protection has resulted in what Stevens has somewhat skeptically described a protection industry, whose product, or maybe its principal commodity would be a better term, is a package of neologisms for rights and for obligations that no intergovernmental body can actually deliver or guarantee. As he puts it, Stevens puts it, the literature abounds with new concepts. We have temporary protection, surrogate protection, complementary protection, humanitarian protection, protection space, all of which sit alongside the old international protection or diplomatic protection that are relevant to the story we're telling. Our argument, these are all legal scholars that I've just cited, who have been debating with one another exactly what the meaning of protection is. Each of them develops really strong arguments for how you finally get to the right definition of protection under the UN Refugee Convention. Our position, as academics who are not trying to implement any definition of this in the courts, is that the language of protection cannot be disambiguated. On the other hand, its official genealogy begins to lay bare the problem that the perceived need for a term like protection space exhumes but cannot resolve. A UNHCR PDES report that served as a basis for the Urban Refugee Policy document in 2009, this was a work on Iraq, rehearses a bifurcation of mandates that subsequent claims for protection space will repeatedly enact over the course of the term's career. In it, protection space refers first to an expanded notion of surrogacy that encompasses all activities through which the rights of refugees and asylum seekers are ensured. And then a conceptual shift follows. Adopting the logic of an IASC model referred to as the egg, the expanded space of protection is no longer to be identified solely with the state and the site of its obligations to the dispossessed, typically camps, but with refugees and the rights that they are supposed to carry with them in a deterritorialized albumen you know, egg yolk of international protection, a kind of bubble space of protections that's supposed to move with you whenever you, wherever you go. But the PDES report also introduces a second meaning, a second origin, and it advances a second etymology contrary to the one I've just presented. They state that in countries sensitive to being seen as countries of asylum, protection space is used as a euphemism for asylum space. As a semantic artifact of a deference to sovereigns, the term protection space refers to a zone of coaxed state obligations to protection rather than to a given egg of rights. So in syntagmatic fashion, the report then links protection space with the concept of humanitarian space to describe what is, in the final analysis, nothing more than a space of assistance necessary to secure protections that are revealed to be aspirational only by the second definition, and as they are treated as incomplete by the first. It's a shell game in which the invocation of protection space actually speaks of the assistance necessary to secure protections, even as the invocation of those same protections refers to assistances already completed. In the end, all we are left with is a realm of assistance. To be clear, the extension of protection implied by a deterritorialized concept of protection space is at the same time its revocation. That logical contrariety, irreducible because it describes the constitutive contradictions between the positive sovereignty of states and the negative sovereignty of the international system, is here simultaneously acknowledged and disavowed in exactly the same way that the Better Shelters advocates treated the state of permanent impermanence between impossible resettlement and unthinkable refoulement as a mere sequencing problem. To the degree that the PDES document defines protection space as an environment in which enables the delivery of protection activities and with which the prospect of providing protection is optimized, it splits the difference between the human right to have rights and the state's role as their guarantor into an order that resolves them in a fantasy, in a complex psychological framing of the term that is both anticipatory and retroactive at once. In other words, protection space becomes the form of assistance necessary to realize protection space as a given zone of rights. As I stumble towards a quick speculative conclusion, let me just jump out of my narrative to make it really clear that I really greatly admire Jeff Crisp, who was the author of that 2009 report, because he actually sought to expand the protections of the Convention to Urban Refugees. I now follow him on Twitter because he is one of the most adept critics of the UNHCR staff as they seek to rebrand themselves as smart humanitarians. He's actually trolling them mercilessly, and it's a lot of fun to watch. But to anticipate some of the questions that may come up, I don't know when I'm done, it's also clear that our concerns differ. CRISP has sought to combat the erosion of protection in new arguments for its expansion. I'm attempting to understand how the concept of protection space participates in the presentation of abandonment as if it were a triumph of cosmopolitan duty to begin with, as well as with the ways that it has always been marked by what Jacques Derrida has called an always possible perversion of the law of hospitality into its contrary, the valorization of rightless relief. So from the standpoint of the global shelter imaginary, I mean, Walter Benjamin had this really beautiful statement in his Origins of German Tragic Drama, in which he says that, you know, from the standpoint of death, the product of the corpse is life. In a similar way, from the standpoint of the global shelter imaginary, from the standpoint of the humanitarian order's subordination of the refugee to the given notions of refuge, the question here is not what protection space fails to deliver to the dispossessed, but rather what work it does for the current humanitarian order. What does the elimination of protection under the sign or image of its universal extension actually potentiate, actually make possible? We are offered, after all, a kind of politics in which human beings are now imagined to be surrounded by a kind of egg of protections, of rights, that they can take with them anywhere they go, in a context where, at the same time, the most minimal protections once offered on the conditions of internment, refugee camps, are themselves now being rendered precarious, if not obsolete. So this is actually quite important. Indeed, this inverse relation between claims for a new, extensible, and universal image of protection on one hand, and the abandonment of the protection mandate on the other, points us towards a possible answer, or at least a provisional one, because the UNHCR's regular acknowledgement that protection space and its sister concept, humanitarian space, are always shrinking, seems to coincide with and motivate further expansions of the protection space argument. So, for example, the public statements of Erica Feller, who was the UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Protection in the years following the 2009 urban refugee policy, repeatedly referred to protection space in relation to what she calls a degraded asylum architecture, even as she continues to normalize the concept of protection space as a done deal. The more Feller spoke of action for the sake of inaction, the more protection space became something notional, to cite Kelly Oliver's carceral humanitarianism. And that is exactly the point. The triumph of a notional protection indistinct from assistance, or more properly, the success of a syntagmatic substitution whereby assistance presents itself as a surrogate for the surrogate rights that are supposed to be delivered to the refugee under international conventions, is actually co-constitutive with transformations in the global shelter imaginary. If the better shelter partnership between the world's largest provider of home furnishings, IKEA, and the planet's biggest refugee landlord, the UNHCR, brilliantly instituted architecture as a kind of surrogate, a plenipotentiary for the valorization of rightless relief, then protection space, which aimed to contend with the urban refugees who are the majority of the world's dispossessed, introduced itself as both a crisis and a tremendous market opportunity in the imagineering of assistance as protection. The subordination of the refugee to the new predispositives of assistance actually presupposes a corollary to the flat pack dwelling at the level of representation. And here it is. Our entire book is basically organized on the passage, politically and logically, between an IKEA refugee and an Airbnb refugee. This is the paradigm shift. To finish, between IKEA on one hand and Airbnb on the other, the claim of the refugee on our political understanding, on our political cognition, it seems to us is for all intents and purposes dissipated. What remains instead is a sociodicy of relief that is advanced in nothing more than the trafficking of symbolic goods depicting the social good. That is what remains of our humanitarian order. Thanks so much.